What do writers do when they seriously notice the world?
Writer and literary critic James Wood.
The writer's task is to bring meaning, color, and life back to the most ordinary things, to soccer boots and grass, to cranes and trees and airports, and even to Gibson guitars and Roland amplifiers and Old Spice and Ajax.
James Wood is often called the best critic of his generation. He made his name writing, I don't want to call them hatchet jobs exactly, but extremely scathing book reviews. That was when he was in his 20s and working for The Guardian. Today he's a staff writer at The New Yorker and a professor of literary criticism at Harvard. It's hard to explain his status in the book world. There's one blogger who put it nicely recently. He said he's arguably the most celebrated, possibly the most impugned, and definitely the most envied literary journalist living. James Wood has just published a new collection of essays called The Nearest Thing to Life. And Steve Paulson wanted to know what he thinks he's learned from a lifetime of close reading.
I don't think that I am naturally an especially observant person, certainly not visually. I did a lot of music when I was a kid, and so I have good ears, and I'm always listening. But I'm one of those people who tends not to look hard enough at, you know, a tree that I walk past, or to notice, you know, what someone's hands looked like 20 minutes after I said goodbye to them. And I'm aware that literature has helped me to become a better noticer by being so full of noticing itself. And then, of course, as a professional reader, I'm continually sort of training and tutoring that particular art.
And to follow up on the strands of your own life, you are married to a novelist, and you've also mm-hmm. worked with some famous writers. For instance, didn't you once teach a college course with Saul Bellow?
I did. I did indeed. I was brought in because Mr. Bellow was in his 80s and was beginning to lose his memory. And it was felt that it would be useful to have someone else in the class.
So what was your job there?
I had a lovely job. My job was to his deep memory, as is so often the case with people who are beginning to lose their memory, was terrific. His short-term memory was full of lapses. So my job really was to nudge him and prod him. So we did a Dostoevsky novella, we did Tolstoy's Death of Ivan Illich. So when it came to people like Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, I would simply say, now, Mr. Bellow, you grew up in Chicago in the 20s and 30s when writers like Tolstoy or Dostoevsky and your relation to them were vital. You were either a Tolstoyan or a Dostoevskian. Can you just tell the class a little bit about that? And he was off. I mean, it was extraordinary. Right to the end of his life, I used to go to his house sometimes and I would accompany him on the piano. I would play the piano. He would play the recorder. Once I brought my two-year-old daughter and Bellow started singing French children's songs, one after the other. It was extraordinary. In French with all the stanzas and all the verses and the tunes, right? And I said, this is extraordinary. And he said, well, I picked them up when I was in Paris writing The Adventures of Augie March. I had a child. I was pushing the child around in a stroller and I used to sing these songs. And that was 50 or 60 years ago. It was amazing to me.
Wow. Saul Bellow was one of those writers who strived for literary greatness. I mean, he was kind of upfront about this. And there have been a handful of writers who sort of, you know, they wanted to be regarded as great. Is that something that you look for when you pick up a new book? I mean, are you also looking for greatness?
You know what? I think this may be the wisdom of middle age, if one can talk about wisdom of middle age, sort of the reverse of the red sports car, as it were. I think I'm a little less hung up on greatness than I used to be. And maybe correspondingly, I'm a somewhat less severe judge than I used to be.
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, you made your name when you were the chief book reviewer for The Guardian, and you had kind of a reputation for writing brutal reviews.
Yeah, I did. I was always taking people to the cleaners. you know, I still love that kind of sweeping thing of, you know, it's all rubbish, you know, nothing's good being written in England since, you know, 1945. I love to see it in critics because it's a sign to me that they're taking the form deadly seriously.
But it sounds like you're saying that you have become a more generous critic since then.
I think I have, yeah. Indeed, in some respects, I'm slightly put off by massive ambition, you know, by the sort of 600-700-page book that's trying to do 50 things at once. And there's part of me that relishes smaller effects. You know, it's it seems to me that one of the easier things in our culture now is to make a lot of noise. And this can be aided and abetted often by, you know, the publishing machinery that happily says, you know, you're young, you're making a lot of noise, we will anoint you as a noisemaker, a.k.a. ambitious, and we'll push the book out there. You know, I think obviously it's important still to take note of those big attempts that are being made to write great literature. But I'm also interested in simplicity.
Now, in addition to being a book critic, you also teach a class at Harvard on the practice of literary criticism. So what is the art of being a good book critic?
I think it's the art of persuasion. You know, one of the ways in which I get both institutional respect, a rather tiresome kind, and a fair amount of attack because of that institutional authority has to do with this thing of, you know, being at The New Yorker. Then when you, as it were, square it with the Harvard thing, you get a sort of horrific, sort of horrible
your pedestal, you know, you stand like, on is pretty tall.
Right. Here's your throne, and we'll build an extra, you know, 10 feet of gold for you to sit on for the pedestal. And that's really tiresome to me, as is the whole thing about being, you know, this awful word, gatekeeper, you know, sort of gatekeeper critic. I can't think of anything worse, and by the way, more corrupting to the soul than to think that, you know, by a stroke of the pen, you know, I command this or that person's career or reputation.
Can you still read purely for pleasure without always having your critical hat on, even if it's a book that you're not reviewing?
Well, I think the way to answer that is I can't read without my critical hat on, but I don't think that reading with my critical hat on is incompatible with pleasure or even with pure pleasure in the way that, you know, that I might, you know, secretly be in love with really bad television. I mean, I understand what the phrase pure pleasure is getting at, which would be some kind of surrendering to the text without really much self-consciousness at all.
Well, and without feeling compelled to evaluate it.
I'm always evaluating it. But then when I think back, I realize that I always was anyway, and that for me, pleasure is evaluative pleasure as well as the pure enjoyment of, you know, just, which I certainly still experience, of, you know, wanting to put an exclamation mark in the margin of the page because I've just been bowled over by something. You know, wow, just the wow thing is very strong in me.
Now, you mentioned that you have kind of a guilty pleasure of watching mainstream TV shows. Do you also have guilty literary pleasures?
Here's the thing. I don't really have guilty literary pleasures. I don't know what the explanation for it is, because I certainly have literary friends who love genre fiction, whether it's science fiction or, you know, thrillers. I never read that stuff. I never did. I never have done. Sometimes I think that's just me being slightly anxious. I put it down.
Anxious.
Right. I put it down to a sort of literary anxiety that somehow I don't have the time for it.
You don't think it's good enough, right?
Right. I don't think it's good enough. But then the reason I say that I think it's anxious is it's not like I'm a man without guilty pleasures. So if I have guilty pleasures in other areas, we mentioned TV, that's certainly one. What other guilty pleasures? I mean, you know, I love cars, right? I absolutely love cars. So I read car magazines. You know, car magazines are, you know, it's not exactly a sin to read a car magazine, but you know, they are what they are. It's essentially, you know, car porn. So I'm not without guilty pleasures. I know what it means to sort of balance the high and the low and to be hospitable towards the low or relaxed around the low.
You just don't want that in your literature.
I don't want it in my... I actually think it might contaminate in some way. That's where I think I'm a little bit anxious.
Hmm. You wrote one novel yourself. Do you have a hankering to write more fiction?
I do. I'm actually working at a novel right now. My wife, who's a novelist, will often say, you know, you sit down and you think, okay, I'm just going to start writing. And then you look up 3.5 hours later and you really didn't know where the time went. You got lost. And that getting lost is clearly crucially important for creativity, but also a source of terror for me, because I don't know what I'm holding on to anymore. I don't know where the thread is going, and I don't quite know how to find it again.
You also must figure that all those writers out there are sharpening their daggers waiting for your book to come out.
Oh, indeed. It's a perpetual fantasy of mine to, as it was with the first novel, to publish it under a pseudonym. Of course, it's a bit of a wager because there's first the wager of will you get it published?
Of course you'll get it published. I mean, if you did it
under a pseudonym,
oh, yes.
If you just sent it as a pseudonym, there's a possibility that it wouldn't get published.
Right.
And then if you continue the wager, there's a possibility that it wouldn't get reviewed at all and would just disappear. And you're the sore loser. There's no kind of triumphal announcement a year later. Ah, this book that everyone's been paying attention is actually by James Wood. In fact, it just disappeared under its pseudonym. I used to write occasionally pseudonymous things when I was... When I was first starting out, I have two middle names, Douglas and Graham, and I needed to earn a living writing paperback roundup reviews. And I thought this hack work, which it really is, it's little more than just 50-word précis stuff, should exist in a different, slightly different realm from what I was trying to do as a fiction reviewer. So for a while I was writing under James Wood and Douglas Graham, so maybe that's what I should do with the novel, although I've just blown my cover on radio.
That's New Yorker critic James Wood. His new book is called The Nearest Thing to Life. You can read the full interview in Electric Lit. The link's on our website at ttbook.org.